This is Audible.
You're listening to the audio production of The Same Kind of Different as Me by Ron Hall and Denver Moore with Lynn Vincent. Published by Thomas Nelson and read by Daniel Butler as Ron and Barry Scott as Denver. And be sure to stay tuned at the end of this audiobook to hear a very special excerpt from Working Our Way Home, Ron Hall's upcoming book that continues to chronicle his legendary friendship with the unforgettable Denver Moore.
Chapter 1. Well, a poor Lazarus, poor as I, when he died, he had a home on high. The rich man died and lived so well, when he died, he had a home in hell. You better get a home in that rock, don't you see? Until Miss Debbie, I never spoke to no white woman before. Just answered a few questions, maybe. It wasn't really speaking, and to me, even that was a mighty risky, since the last time I was fool enough to open my mouth to a white woman, I wound up half dead and nearly blind. I was maybe 15, 16 years old, walking down the red dirt road that passed by the front of the cotton plantation where I lived in Red River Parish, Louisiana. The plantation was big and flat, like a whole lot of farms put together with a bayou snaking all through it. Cypress trees squatted like spiders in the water, which was the color of pale green apples. There was a lot of different fields on that spread, maybe 100, 200 acres each, lined off with hardwood trees, mostly pecans. Wasn't too many trees right by the road, though. So when I was walking that day on my way back from my auntie's house, she was my grandma's sister on my daddy's side. I was right out in the open. Pretty soon, I seen this white lady standing by her car, a blue Ford, about a 1950-51 model, something like that. She was standing there in her hat and her skirt, like maybe she'd been to town. Looked to me like she was trying to figure out how to fix a flat tire. So I stopped. "You need some help, ma'am?" "Yes, thank you," she said, looking pretty grateful to tell you the truth. "I really do." I asked her, did she have a jack? She said she did, and that was all we said. Well, about the time I got the tire fixed, here come three white boys riding out of the woods on bay horses. They'd been hunting, I think, and they come trotting up and didn't see me because they was in the road and I was ducked down fixing the tire on the other side of the car. Red dust from the horses' tracks floated up over me. First, I got still, thinking I'd wait for them to go on by. Then I decided I didn't want them to think I was hiding, so I started to stand up. Right then, one of them asked the white lady, did she need any help? "I reckon not," a red-headed fella with big teeth said when he spotted me. "She got a nigger helping her." Another one, dark-haired and kind of weasel-looking, put one hand on his saddle horse, pushed back his hat with the other. "Boy, what you doing bothering this nice lady?" He wasn't nothing but a boy himself, maybe 18, 19 years old. I didn't say nothing, just looked at him. "What you looking at, boy?" he said and spat in the dirt. The other two just laughed. The white lady didn't say nothing, just looked down at her shoes. Except for the horses chuffing, things got quiet, like the yellow spell before a cyclone. Then the boy closest to me slung a grass rope round my neck, like he was roping a calf. He jerked it tight, cutting my breath. The noose poked into my neck like burrs, and fear crawled up through my legs into my belly. I caught a look at all three of them boys. I remember thinking none of them was much older than me, but their eyes was flat and mean. "We gonna teach you a lesson about bothering white ladies," said the one holding the rope. That was the last thing them boys said to me. I don't like to talk much about what happened next, 'cause I ain't looking for no pity party. That's just how things was in Louisiana in those days. Mississippi, too, I reckon. Since a couple of years later, folks started telling the story about a young colored fella named Emmett Till, who got beat till you couldn't tell who he was no more. He whistled at a white woman, and some other good old boys, seemed like them woods was full of them, didn't like that one iota. They beat that boy till one of his eyeballs fell out, then tied a cotton gin fan round his neck, throwed him off a bridge into the Tallahatchie River. Folks say, if you was to walk across that bridge today, you could still hear that drowned young man crying out from the water. There was lots of Emmett Tills. Only most of them didn't make the news. Folks says the bayou in Red River Parish is full to its pea-green brim with the splintery bones of colored folks that white men done fed to the gators for coveting their women. Or maybe just looking cross-eyed. Wasn't like it happened every day, but the chance of it, the threat of it, hung over the cotton field like a ghost. I worked them fields for nearly 30 years, like a slave. Even though slavery had supposedly ended when my grandma was just a girl, I had a shack I didn't own, 2 pairs of overalls I got on credit, a hog, and an outhouse. I worked them fields, planting and plowing and picking and giving all the cotton to the man that owned the land, all without no paycheck. I didn't even know what a paycheck was. It might be hard for you to imagine, but I worked like that while the seasons rolled by from the time I was a little bitty boy all the way past the time that President named Kennedy got shot dead in Dallas. All them years. There was a freight train that used to roll through Red River Parish on some tracks right out there by Highway 1. Every day, I hear whistle and moan. I used to imagine it calling out about the places it could take me, like New York City or Detroit, where I heard a colored man could get paid, or California, where I heard nearly everybody that breathed was stacking up paper money like flapjacks. One day, I just got tired of being poor, so I walked out to Highway 1, waited for that train to slow down some, and jumped on it. I didn't get off till the doors opened up again, which happened to be in Fort Worth, Texas. Now, when a black man who can't read, can't write, can't figure, and don't know how to work nothing but cotton comes to the big city, he don't have too many of what white folks call career opportunities. That's how come I wound up sleeping on the streets. I ain't gonna sugarcoat it. The streets will turn a man nasty. And I've been nasty, homeless, in scrapes with the law, in Angola prison, and homeless again for a lot of years by the time I met Miss Debbie. I want to tell you this about her. She was the skinniest, nosiest, pushiest woman I had ever met, black or white. She was so pushy, I couldn't keep her from finding out my name was Denver. She investigated till she found it out on her own. For a long time, I tried to stay completely out of her way. But after a while, Miss Debbie got me to talking about things I don't like to talk about and telling things I ain't never told nobody, even about them 3 boys with the rope. Some of them things I'm fixing to tell you.
Chapter 2. Life produces some inglorious moments that live forever in your mind. One from 1952 remains seared on my brain like the brand on a longhorn steer. In those days, all school children had to bring urine samples to school, which public health workers would then screen for dread diseases. As a second grader at Riverside Elementary in Fort Worth, Texas, I carefully carried my pee to school in a Dixie cup, like all the other good boys and girls. But instead of taking it to the school nurse, I mistakenly took it directly to Miss Poe, the meanest and ugliest teacher I ever had. My error sent her into a hissy fit, so well developed, you'd have thought I'd poured my sample directly into the coffee cup on her desk. To punish me, she frog-marched me and the whole second-grade class out to the playground like a drill sergeant and clapped us to attention. "Class, I have an announcement," she rasped, her smoke-infected voice screeching like bad brakes on an 18-wheeler. "Ronnie Hall will not be participating in recess today because he was stupid enough to bring his Dixie cup to the classroom instead of the nurse's office. He will spend the next 30 minutes with his nose in a circle." Miss Poe then produced a fresh stick of chalk and scrawled on the red brick schoolhouse wall a circle approximately 3 inches above the spot where my nose would touch if I stood on flat feet. Humiliated, I slunk forward, hiked up on tiptoes, and stuck my nose on the wall. After 5 minutes, my eyes crossed, and I had to close them, remembering that my mama had warned me never to look cross-eyed or they could get locked up that way. After 15 minutes, my toes and calves cramped fiercely, and after 20 minutes, my tears washed the bottom half of Miss Poe's circle right off the wall. With the strain of loathing peculiar to a child's shame, I hated Miss Poe for that. And as I grew older, I wished I could send her a message that I wasn't stupid. I hadn't thought of her in years, though, until a gorgeous day in June 1978, when I cruised down North Main Street in Fort Worth in my Mercedes convertible, and security waved me through the gate onto the private tarmac at Meacham Airfield like a rock star. It would have been perfect if I could have had Miss Poe, a couple of old girlfriends, Lana and Rita Gale, maybe. And what the heck? My whole 1963 Haltom High graduating class lined up parade style so they could all see how I'd risen above my lower middle-class upbringing. Looking back, I'm surprised I made it to the airfield that day, since I'd spent the whole 10-mile trip from home admiring myself in the rearview mirror. I guided the car to the spot where a pilot stood waiting before a private Falcon jet, dressed in black slacks, a starched white shirt, and spit-shined cowboy boots. He raised his hand in greeting, squinting against the Texas heat already boiling up from the tarmac. "Good morning, Mr. Hall," he called over the turbine's hum. "Need some help with those paintings?" Carefully, and one at a time, we moved 3 Georgia O'Keeffe paintings from the Mercedes to the Falcon. Together, the paintings were valued at just shy of $1 million. 2 years earlier, I had sold the same collection, 2 of O'Keeffe's iconic flower paintings and 1 of a skull, to a wildly wealthy South Texas woman for $500,000. When she tore a personal check for the full amount from her Hermes leather checkbook, I asked her jokingly if she was sure her check was good. "I hope so, hon," she said, smiling through her syrupy sweet Texas drawl. "I own the bank." Now that client was divesting herself of both a gold-digging husband and the O'Keeffes. The new buyer, an elegant 50-ish woman who owned one of the finest apartments on Madison Avenue and probably wore pearls while bathing, was also divorcing. She was hosting a luncheon for me and a couple of her artsy socialite friends that afternoon to celebrate her new acquisitions. No doubt an adherent to the philosophy that living well is the best revenge, she had used part of her King's Ransom divorce settlement to purchase the O'Keeffes at nearly double their former value. She was far too rich to negotiate the $1 million price tag. That suited me just fine, since it made my commission on the deal an even $100,000. My client had sent the Falcon down from New York to retrieve me. Inside, I stretched out in a buttercream leather seat and perused the day's headlines. The pilot arrowed down the runway, took off to the south, then banked gently north. On the climb out, I gazed down at Fort Worth, a city about to be transformed by local billionaires. It was much more than a facelift. Giant holes in the ground announced the imminent construction of great gleaming towers of glass and steel. Galleries, cafes, museums, and upscale hotels would soon rise to join banks and legal offices, turning downtown Fort Worth from a sleepy cowtown into an urban epicenter with a pulse. So ambitious was the project that it was systematically displacing the city's homeless population, which was actually a stated goal, a way to make our city a nicer place to live. Looking down from 3,000 feet, I was secretly glad they were pushing the bums to the other side of the tracks, as I despised being panhandled every day on my way to work out at the Fort Worth Club. My wife, Debbie, didn't know I felt quite that strongly about it. I played my nouveau elitism pretty close to the vest. After all, it had been only 9 years since I'd been making $450 a month selling Campbell's soup for a living, and only 7 since I'd bought and sold my first painting, secretly stealing Debbie's 50 shares of Ford Motor Company stock, a gift from her parents when she graduated from Texas Christian University. Ancient history, as far as I was concerned. I had shot like a rocket from canned soup to investment banking to the apex of the art world. The plain truth was, God had blessed me with 2 good eyes, one for art and the other for a bargain. But you couldn't have told me that at the time. To my way of thinking, I'd bootstrapped my way from lower middle-class country boy into the rarefied atmosphere that oxygenates the lifestyles of the Forbes 400. Debbie had threatened to divorce me for using the Ford stock. The only thing I owned outright myself, she fumed. But I nudged her toward a cautious forgiveness with shameless bribes, a gold Piaget watch, and a mink jacket from Koslow's. At first, I dabbled in art sales while keeping my investment banking day job. But in 1975, I cleared $10,000 on a Charles Russell painting I sold to a man in Beverly Hills who wore gold-tipped white python cowboy boots and a diamond-studded belt buckle the size of a dinner plate. After that, I quit banking and ventured out to walk the art world tight wire without a net. It paid off. In 1977, I sold my first Renoir, then spent a month in Europe, spreading my name and news of my keen eye among the old world art elite. It didn't take long for the zeros to begin piling up in the bank accounts of Ron and Debbie Hall. We didn't enjoy the same income level as my clients, whose average net worth notched in somewhere between 50 and 200 million. But they invited us into their stratosphere, yachting in the Caribbean, wing shooting in the Yucatan, hobnobbing at island resorts and old money mansions. I lapped it up, adopting as standard uniforms a closet full of Armani suits. Debbie was less enamored with the baubles of wealth. In 1981, I called her from the showroom floor of a Scottsdale, Arizona, Rolls-Royce dealer who had taken a shine to an important Western painting I owned. "You're not going to believe what I just traded for," I said the instant she picked up the phone at our home in Fort Worth. I was sitting in the what a $160,000 fire engine red Corniche convertible with white leather interior piped in red to match. I jabbered a description into my satellite phone. Debbie listened carefully, then delivered her verdict. "Don't you dare bring that thing home. Don't even drive it out of the showroom. I'd be embarrassed to be seen in a car like that, or even have it in our driveway." Had she really just called a top-of-the-line Rolls that thing? I think it would be fun, I volunteered. "Ron, honey." "Yes," I said, suddenly hopeful at her sweet tone. "Does that Rolls have a rearview mirror?" "Yes." "Look in it," she said. "Do you see a rock star?" No. "Just remember, you sell pictures for a living. Now get out of the Rolls, get your Haltom City butt on a plane, and come home." I did. The same year Debbie snubbed the Rolls, I opened a new gallery on Main Street in Fort Worth's blossoming cultural district, an area called Sundance Square, and hired a woman named Patty to manage it. Though we displayed Impressionist and modern master paintings, Monet, Picasso, and their peers, worth several $100,000, we were careful about posting prices or keeping too much inventory on site, as a good number of derelicts had not yet been convinced to move to their new accommodations under the freeways to the southeast. Greasy and smelly, several came in each day to cool down, warm up, or case the place. Most of them were black, and I felt sure they all were also alcoholics and addicts, though I had never taken the time to hear their stories. I didn't really care. One day, a drug-dazed black man, filthy in thread-worn army fatigues, shambled into the gallery.
"How much you want for that picture?" he slurred, jabbing his finger at a $250,000 Mary Cassatt.
Fearing he might rob me, I tried to humor him while evading the truth.
"How much you got in your pocket?"
$50, he said.
"Then give it to me, and you can walk out the door with that picture."
"No, sir, I ain't giving you $50 for that picture." "Well, this isn't a museum, and I didn't charge admission, so if you're not buying, how am I supposed to pay the rent?" I then invited him to leave. A few days later, he returned with an equally nasty-looking partner and perpetrated a little smash-and-grab, bursting out onto the sidewalk with a sack full of cash and artisan jewelry. Patty hit the real-life panic button we had installed, and I ran down from the upstairs suite, commencing a classic movie-style chase, with the robbers ducking down alleys and leaping trash cans, and me in hot pursuit yelling, "Stop those men! I've been robbed!" I sprinted at first, but slowed down a little after it occurred to me to wonder what I would do with the bums if I caught them. I yelled louder to make up for running slower. By the time the police collared them a few blocks away, the crooks were empty-handed, having left a 10-block trail of jewelry and $20 bills. The incident firmly fixed my image of homeless people as a ragtag army of ants bent on ruining decent people's picnics. I had no idea at that time that God, in his elaborate sense of humor, was laying the groundwork for one of them to change my life.
Chapter 3. Nobody ever told me how I got my name Denver. For the longest time, nobody ever called me nothing but Little Buddy. Supposedly, when I was just a little bitty fella, Pawpaw, my granddaddy, used to carry me around in the front pocket of his overalls. So that's why they called me Little Buddy, I guess. I never really knowed much about my mama. She was just a young girl, too young to take good care of me. So she did what she had to do and gave me over to Paw Paw and Big Mama. That's just the way things was on the plantations and the farms in Red River Parish. Colored families came in all different shapes and sizes. You might have a grown woman living in a shotgun shack, picking cotton and raising her own brothers and sisters, and that would be a family. Or you might have an uncle and aunt raising her sister's kids, and that would be a family. A lot of children just had a mama and no daddy. Part of that come from being poor. I know that ain't no popular thing to say in this day and age, but that was the truth. A lot of times, the men would be sharecropping on them plantations and look around and wonder why they was working the land so hard, and every year, the man that owned the land be taking all the profits. Since there ain't no sharecropping now, I'm going to tell you how it worked. The man owned the land. Then he give you the cotton seeds and the fertilizer and the mule and some clothes and everything else you need to get through the year. Except he don't really give it to you. He let you buy it at a store on credit. But it was his store on his plantation that he owned. You plowed and planted and tended till picking time. Then at the end of the year, when you bring in the cotton, you go to the man and settle up. Supposedly, you're going to split that cotton right down the middle, or maybe 60-40. But by the time the crop comes in, you owe the man so much on credit, your share of the crop gets eat up. And even if you don't think you owe that much, or even if the crop was especially good that year, the man weighs the cotton, writes down the figures, and he is the only one that can read the scale or the books. So you done worked all year, and the man ain't done nothing, but you still owe the man. And wasn't nothing you could do but work his land for another year to pay off that debt. What it come down to was, the man didn't just own the land, he owned you. Got so there was a saying that went like this, an art's an art, a figure's a figure. All for the white man, none for the nigger. When I was just a little fella, folks said there was a man named Roosevelt who lived in a white house and that he was trying to make things better for colored folks. But there was a whole lot of white folks, especially sheriffs, that liked things just the way they was. A lot of times, this was mighty discouraging to the colored men, and they would just up and leave, abandoning their women and children. Some was bad men, but some was just ashamed they couldn't do no better. That ain't no excuse, but it's the God-honest truth. I didn't know hardly nobody that had a mama and daddy both. So me and my big brother, Thurman, lived with Big Mama and Paw Paw. And we didn't think nothing of it. We had a sister, too, Herschel Lee. But she was already grown and lived down the road a ways. Big Mama was my daddy's mama. Except I didn't call him daddy. I called him B.B. He'd come around the house every now and then. He lived with Big Mama and Paw Paw in a three-room shack with cracks in the floors big enough to see the ground through. Wasn't no windows, just wooden shutters. We didn't mind the holes in the floor when it was hot out, but in the wintertime, the cold would stick its ugly head up between the cracks and bite us. We tried to knock it back with some loose boards or tops of tin cans. Now Big Mama and Paw Paw made quite a pair. Big Mama was a big woman. And I don't mean just big-boned. She was big sideways, north to south, all the way round. She used to make up her own dresses out of flour sacks. In those days, flour sacks was kind of pretty. They might come printed up with flowers on them or birds. It took 7 or 8 right big ones to make Big Mama a dress. On the other hand, Pawpaw was kind of smallish. Standing next to Big Mama, he looked downright puny. She could beat him down, I guess, but she was a quiet woman and kind. I never heard her whooping nobody or ever raising her voice. Wasn't no mistaking, though. She did run the place. Pawpaw didn't run nothing but his mouth, but he took care of Big Mama. She didn't have to go out in the fields and work. She was busy raising her grandbabies. She wasn't just my grandma, though. Big Mama was my best friend. I loved her and used to take care of her, too. She was kind of sick when I was a little boy. She had a lot of pain. I used to give her her medicine. I don't know exactly what kind of pills they was, but she used to call them red devils. "Little buddy, go on and get Big Mama two of them red devils," she'd say. "I needs to get easy." I did a lot of special things for Big Mama, like taking out the slop jar or catching a chicken in the yard and wringing its neck off so she could fry it up for supper. Now, every year, Pawpaw raised us a turkey for Thanksgiving. Fed him special to get him nice and fat. First year, she thought I was big enough. Big Mama said, "Little buddy, get on outside and wring that turkey's neck off. I'm fixing to cook him up." I'm telling you what, that turned out to be a tough road to hoe. When I took out after that Tom, he lit out like he was running from the devil himself. He zigged and zagged, kicking up dirt and squawking like I was killing him already. I chased that bird till I thought my legs would give out. Until that day, I didn't know a turkey could fly. He took off just like an aeroplane and set himself down way up high in a cypress tree. That bird wasn't no fool, neither. He didn't come back down till 3 or 4 days after Thanksgiving. Made us have to eat chicken that year. When that turkey flew the coop, I thought I was going to get my first whooping for sure. But Big Mama just laughed till I thought she would bust. I guess that's because she knowed I did the best I could. She trusted me like that. Matter of fact, she trusted me more than she trusted my daddy and my uncles, her own sons. Like that money belt she kept tied around her waist. I was the only one she let go up under her dress to get the money out. "Little buddy, get up under there and get me out 2 dimes and a quarter, she'd say. And I'd get that money and give it to whoever she wanted to have it. Big Mama always had something for me. Some peppermint candy or maybe some bottle caps so I could make me a truck. If I wanted a truck, I'd get a block of wood and a nail on 4 bottle caps, 2 on the front and 2 on the back. And I had me a truck. I could roll around in the dirt. But them times was few and far between. I never was a playing child. Never asked for no toys at Christmas. Didn't have that in my personality. I guess that's why I acted like I did when the first tragedy come into my life. One night, when I was about 5 or 6, Big Mama's leg was giving her fits, and she had asked me for 2 of them red devils and went on to bed. Wasn't long after that, me and Thurman went on to bed too, even though our cousin Chuck said he was going to sit up for a while beside the fire. He'd been staying with us. Me and Thurman had a room in the back of the house. I didn't have no proper bed, just a mattress set up on wood boards and cement blocks. Kind of liked it, though, because I had a window right over my head. In the summertime, I could leave the shutters open and smell the warm earth and look up at the stars winking at me. Seemed like there was more stars in those days than there is now. Wasn't no electric lights blotting out the sky, except for the moon cutting a hole in the dark. The nights was just as black as molasses, and the stars glittered like broken glass in the sun. Now, I had me a little cat that I had found when he was just a little fur ball of a kitten. I don't even remember what I called him now, but he used to sleep on my chest every night. His fur tickled my chin, and his purring was just like a tonic to me. Had a rhythm soothed me right to sleep. That night, though, seemed like I'd been sleeping quite a while when that cat jumped off my chest and scratched me. I woke up with a holler, and the cat hopped up in the window and started meowing real hard and wouldn't quit. So I got up to see what was wrong with the cat, and in the moonlight, I could see smoke in the house. First, I thought I was hallucinating and rubbed my eyes, but when I opened them up again, that smoke was still there. Turning round and round, first thing I did was shoo my cat out the window. Then I ran into Big Mama's room, but I didn't see no fire. I knew the house was burning, though, 'cause that smoke started piling up real thick. Even though I couldn't see no flames, it felt like there was fire burning my throat and my eyes. I started coughing real bad and ran to the front door, but Pawpaw had already gone to work and locked it. I know the back door had a wooden latch on it that I could barely reach. I ran back to my room and tried to wake up my brother. "Thurman, Thurman, the house is on fire. Thurman, wake up." I kept shaking and shaking him, but he was hard sleeping. Finally, I jerked the covers off of him and grabbed back a fist and hit him upside the head just as hard as I could. He jumped up then, mad as a wet cat, and tackled me. We rolled on the floor just a scrapping, and I kept trying to yell at him that the house was on fire. He caught on after a minute, and me and him jumped out the window into the Johnson grass outside. Even though he was bigger than me, Thurman plopped down on the ground and started crying. I tried to think real fast, what could I do? Big Mama was still in the house, and so was Chook. I decided to go back in and try to get him out. I jumped up, grabbed the edge of the window, and shimmied up the side of the house, climbing the boards with my bare toes. When I got inside, I ran out into the front room, staying down low under the smoke. There was Chook, sitting by the fireplace, with a poker in his hand, just staring with his eyes all glazed up. "Chook, the house on fire. Help me get Big Mama. We got to get out." But Chook just kept poking in the fireplace like he was in a trance. I looked up and seen sparks shooting down out of the chimney, spinning off into the smoke like whirligigs. That's when I know the chimney was on fire and probably the roof. I was coughing and coughing by then, but I had to try to save my grandma. I scrunched down low and found my way back to her room. I could see her face, sleeping hard like Thurman had been. And I shook her and shook her, but she wouldn't wake up. "Big Mama, Big Mama," I screamed right in her ear, but she acted more like she was dead than sleeping. I could hear the fire in the chimney now, roaring low like a train. I pulled and pulled on Big Mama, trying to drag her out the bed, but she was too heavy. "Big Mama, please. Big Mama, wake up. The house on fire." I thought maybe the smoke had done got her, and my heart broke in half right there where I was standing. I could feel tears running down my face, part from grief and part from the smoke. It was getting real hot, and I knowed I had to come up out of there, or I'd be done in too. I ran out into the front room, hollering and screaming, coughing at Chook. "You got to get out, Chook. Smoke done got Big Mama. Come on up out of here." Chook just turned and looked at me with eyes that looked like he was already dead. "No, I'm going to stay here with Big Mama." I can't explain why, but he wasn't even coughing or nothing. Then he went back to poking in the fireplace. That's when I heard a cracking noise that made me freeze and look up. The roof was fixing to cave in. The smoke started to get so thick I couldn't see Chook no more. I got down on my hands and knees and felt my way till I felt the feet of the potbelly stove. Then I knowed I was close to the back door. I crawled a little further till I could see a little crack of daylight sliding up under the door. I stood up and stretched just as high as I could to where I could just barely reach that wooden latch with the tips of my fingers. Then the door burst open and I rolled out, with the black smoke boiling out after me like a pack of demons. I ran around to find Thurman on the side of the house by Big Mama's room, just squalling. I was crying, too. We could see tongues of fire licking down from under the eaves till they grabbed hold of some boards and began to burn down the sides of the house. The heat pushed us back, but I couldn't stop hollering, "Big Mama! Big Mama!" The fire swirled up into the dawn like a cyclone, roaring and popping, sending out the black smell of things that ain't supposed to be burning. The horriblest thing was when the roof fell in, 'cause that's when Big Mama finally woke up. Between the flames and smoke, I could see her rolling around and calling out to the Lord, "Help me, Jesus, save me." She hollered, trashing and coughing in the smoke. Then there was a loud crack, and Big Mama screamed. I saw a big piece of wood crash down and pin her on the bed. She couldn't move no more, but she kept hollering, "Lord Jesus, save me." I only heard Chook holler one time, then he was quiet. I stood there and screamed and watched my grandmother burn up.
Chapter 4. As I mentioned, I did not start out rich. I was raised in a lower middle class section of Fort Worth called Haltom City, a town so ugly that it was the only one in Texas with no picture postcard of itself for sale in the local pharmacy. No mystery there. Who would want to commemorate a visit to a place where a shabby-looking house trailer or cars stripped for parts squatted in every other yard, guarded by mongrel dogs on long chains? We used to joke that the only heavy industry in Haltom City was the 300-pound Avon lady. My daddy, Earl, was raised by a single mother and two old maid aunts who dipped Garrett snuff till it ran down their chins and dried in the wrinkles. I hated to kiss them. Daddy started out a comical, fun-loving man who retired from Coca-Cola after 40-odd years of service. But somewhere during my childhood, he crawled into a whiskey bottle and didn't come out till I was grown. My mama, Tommy, was a farm girl from Barry, Texas, who sewed every stitch of clothing we wore, baked cookies, and cheered me on at Little League. As a girl, she and her sister and brother all rode a horse to school. The same horse, all at once. Her brother's name was Buddy, and her sister's name was Elvis, which was pronounced Elvis, a fact that would later become something of a problem. Tommy, Buddy, Elvis, and later Vida Mae, the youngest, all picked cotton on the Blackland farm owned by their daddy and my granddaddy, Mr. Jack Brooks. Now, most people are not in the market for Texas Blackland farms, as they are not at all romantic. The topography is mainly flat, so there is a scarcity of sunset-washed knolls from which to gaze upon your plantation house and declare that some Irish love of the land will soon seize your soul. In fact, the land itself is miserable, cursed with soil that may well be the original inspiration for cement.
The flimsiest morning mist will cause a man in work boots to pull up a mud stump every time he takes a step. A half-inch rain will motivate even the most determined farmer to throw his tractor in low and head for the blacktop if he doesn't want to spend the next day cussing while he digs out his John Deere. That is not to say my granddaddy's place outside Corsicana, about 75 miles southeast of Fort Worth, wasn't pleasant in a rural way. My brother John and I spent our summers there by choice, an option we considered far superior to 3 months of hunting down our daddy at the tailless monkey lounge. 9 months of that a year was enough for us. So every June, when Mama drove us out to the home place, we leaped out of her Pontiac and ran toward Granddaddy at Mama's green asphalt-shingled farmhouse with the joy of soldiers on furlough. Raised in the 1920s, the house was built like a box. I don't remember when they got indoor plumbing, but while I was a boy, a cistern squatted by the back door to catch rainwater running off the roof. Mama had a white porcelain pan sitting on the back porch. When we came in for supper, we'd draw some water out of the cistern and wash our hands with a bar of lava soap, which is about like washing with sandpaper. But lava is the only kind of soap that get the dirt off a man who'd been working in the fields on a blackland farm. Granddaddy worked like a mule and was a true redneck. That's because he wore khaki pants and a long-sleeved khaki work shirt and work boots 6 days a week. His entire body was snow white, except for his bronzed, leathery hands and, of course, his neck, which was covered east to west with thick wrinkles, colored Indian red like plowed furrows on more gracious land. He was a decent, honest man who would help anyone who needed helping. He was also the hardest working man I ever knew. My Uncle Buddy tells a story about my granddaddy as a poor young man heading back to Texas after World War I. After kicking the crap out of the Germans in France, Granddaddy, in his 20s, had to try to figure out how to keep a wife, raise 4 kids, and pay for a little farm. Along the way, he asked a neighbor, an old farmer named Barnes, how he did it. "Jack, you watch me," Mr. Barnes said. "You work when I work, and go to town when I go to town." As you might expect, Mr. Barnes never went to town, and seldom did my granddaddy. During the Dust Bowl and Great Depression, he hung on tight, so skinny he had to carry rocks in his pockets to keep from blowing away. At a time when even banks had no money, and a man couldn't get a nickel's worth of credit even if his name was Rockefeller, he made it by picking cotton all day and hauling it on a mule wagon to the gin at night. He slept on the cotton till it was his turn to get ginned, drove back to the field at sunrise, and repeated this cotton waltz until the harvest was done. Most summer days, John and I were with Granddaddy in the fields, picking cotton or riding shotgun on the tractor. When we weren't with Granddaddy, we leaned toward trouble. Mama kept a big peach orchard near the road that passed by the farm. I loved the smell of the orchard when the fruit hung ripe and sweet. Ripe peaches also make mean grenades. One day John and I had a contest to see who could lob one far enough and hard enough to nail a passing car. "Betcha I can hit one first," John called from his battle station, high in a tree loaded with ripe fruit. In another tree, I lined up squishy ammo in the crotch between 2 branches. "Betcha can't." It took us several tries, but one of us, we still don't know which, finally managed to bust out the windshield of a 1954 Ford Fairlane. The driver, a woman, pulled over and marched up to the farmhouse to lodge her complaint with Mama. To hear her tell it, you'd have thought we'd shelled her with field artillery. When Granddaddy got home, he cut a switch out of one of those peach trees and wore us out. He also tanned our hides the time we, without permission, repainted the entire chicken house, including the tin roof, a frightening shade of baby blue. Still, Granddaddy himself loved to pull pranks. When I think back on it, I guess some of his pranks weren't pranks so much as him teaching boys to be men. Once he threw John and me in the stock tank to teach us how to swim before he remembered he didn't know how to swim either and couldn't rescue us. Both of us learned to swim real quick. One Christmas we spent at the home place, John and I opened up two shiny packages and each found a pair of boxing gloves. Right there on the spot, Granddaddy loaded us both in his 1947 Chevy pickup and took us into Barry to the filling station, which in those days doubled as a place for old men to play checkers, drink coffee, and talk about the weather and cattle prices. Secretly, Granddaddy had already called the daddies of every kid in town within 3 years of our ages, and that morning they came barreling up to the filling station on clouds of Yuletide dust and formed a pickup truck boxing ring. John and I had to fight every kid in town, and both of us had bloody noses before breakfast, which we thought was great. Granddaddy wore himself out laughing. That, and riding new cabs every Christmas morning, their warm breath carving curlicues in the daybreak chill, are my favorite Christmas memories. On the farm, Mama did her part milking cows, raising kids and a garden, putting up peaches, green beans, and squash for winter, and cooking Granddaddy two chocolate pies a day. He ate one at dinner and the other at supper, and remained a 6'1", 140-pound string bean his whole life. Folks used to say Granddaddy looked like Kildee, the black shoeshine man who worked in the Blooming Grove barbershop. Old Kildee was a beanpole, too, and didn't have a tooth in his head. He used to entertain folks by squinching up his chin to touch his nose. Granddaddy once gave John 50 cents to give Kildee a kiss, which John happily did, not only because he earned 4 bits to spend on candy, but also because everyone loved Kildee. To this day, Kildee is the only black man buried in Rose Hill Cemetery in Blooming Grove, Texas, laid to rest right there amid the expired ancestors of the finest white families in Navarro County. In other parts of the country, maybe dead folks didn't worry so much about the color of neighboring corpses, but the civil rights movement that began to gather steam in the 1950s hopped right over Corsicana, Texas, the way a soaking spring rain can skip over parched land despite a farmer's most fervent prayers. In the 1950s, the Southern social order was as plain to the eye as charcoal in a snowbank. But from the perspective of a small, fair-skinned boy, it was about as much a topic for considered thought as breathing in and out. White families in Corsicana lived mostly on farms or in neat rows of freshly painted homes in town. Colored folks had their own section across the railroad tracks near the cotton gin and the commission company's cattle pens. I don't know if the area had a proper name, but I never heard it called anything but Niggertown. At the time, that didn't seem to be a bad thing, because these were nice folks who lived there, and many of them worked for my granddaddy. As far as I knew, all their first names were Nigger, and their last names were like our first names, Bill, Charlie, Jim, and so forth. Some of them even had Bible names like Abraham, Moses, and Isaac. So there was Nigger Bill and Nigger Moses, but none of them were ever called by a proper first and last name like mine, Ronnie Ray Hall, or my granddaddy's, Jack Brooks. And really, there seemed no reason in those days to know their last names, as no checks were ever written to them, and for sure there were no insurance forms to fill out or anything like that. Not that I thought about it in such detail back then. That was just the way things were. Niggertown was made up row upon row of one- and two-room shacks built of gray plank lumber that looked like it had been salvaged from a shipwreck. Some people used to call them shotgun shacks because, I found out later, they were so small that if you stood in the front door and fired a shotgun into the house, the blast would blow straight out the back door. The houses were all lined up like cars on a used lot and stuck so close together that a really fat person coming out the front door would have had to walk all the way around the block to get in the back. Maybe they had been built somewhere else because there wasn't room enough between them to swing a hammer. It seemed as if someone had just craned them in and plopped them down on sawed-off bois d'arc stumps so you could see all the way underneath them. But that was a good thing, as those open cellars made a perfect place for mongrel dogs and chickens to take cover from the scorching Texas sun. Granddaddy hired lots of colored folks and a few white men to help farm his cotton. Every morning before light, we'd drive a truck into Niggertown and start honking the horn. Anybody, man, woman, or child, capable of chopping weeds and wanting to work that day, would stagger from their shacks, dressing as they came, and climb aboard. There weren't any safety rails or rules about hauling folks. Granddaddy just tried to drive slow enough to keep from throwing anybody off. After a morning chopping cotton, we'd load up all the workers and haul them to the filling station, which doubled as a grocery store. The colored workers would line up before the glass front of the white porcelain meat counter and choose a thick slice of bologna or pickle loaf and a chunk of cheddar cheese. Granddaddy, standing by the cash register, would pay the bill, throwing in a box of saltines and a couple of raw onions for everyone to share. They'd all take their lunches, wrapped in white butcher paper, and go sit on the ground behind the store. There was a cistern out there for drinking with a can strapped with black tape so they wouldn't make a mistake about which one to drink from. With the coloreds taken care of, we'd hop back in the truck and carry any whites who were working that day back to the farmhouse for dinner. Mama always put on a spread, stuff like fried chicken, fresh black-eyed peas, homemade rolls, all hot and buttery, and always a pie or cobbler. Even as a little boy, it bothered me that the colored workers ate lunch meat on the ground behind the filling station, while the white workers gathered like family for hot, home-cooked food. Sometimes I had the urge to do something about it, but I never did. At the end of every workday, Granddaddy paid all the workers the same, $3 or $4 apiece, and carried them back to town. He always gave them a square deal, even making no-interest loans to colored families to carry them through the winter when work was scarce. Jack Brooks made these loans on a handshake and didn't keep books, which made it hard for Mama to know who owed him money. But the Negroes in Corsicana respected him so much that after he died in 1962, several came unbidden to pay both their respects and their debts. From the time I was 6 or 7, I worked out in the fields, chopping cotton beside them. One day when I was about 14, some of those fellows and I were chopping a long row, pouring sweat, and fighting off grasshoppers the size of small foreign cars. Grasshoppers on a blackland farm are evil creatures. They cling to your clothes like burrs and spit a foul brown juice at you when you try to peel them off. That day the air buzzed and sweltered around us till it seemed like Granddaddy had planted his cotton on the surface of some bug-ridden alien sun. To pass the time, two men chopping on either side of me began to discuss their social calendar for the evening. A man everyone called Nigger John, he had worked for Granddaddy since I could remember, hacked his hoe into a fresh patch of Johnson grass and bull nettles. "When the sun gets low," he told his friend Amos, "I'm going to get on up out of here and go down to Fanny's place and get me a beer and a woman. I wish I could go right now, before I burn up." "I'm going with you," Amos announced, "except I can't decide whether to get me one woman and two beers, or one beer and two women." John shot Amos a sly grin. "Why don't you get two women and give one of them to Ronnie Ray here?" Now, I knew Fanny's was what the colors called a juke joint, which by legend meant a dark, smoky den frequented by persons of questionable character. But at age 14, it had never occurred to me that a man could simply get him a woman, much less two. I put my head down and listened close, pretending to bear down on a particularly stubborn clump of weeds. John wasn't buying. "What you so quiet for, Ronnie Ray?" he teased. "You mean to tell me you ain't never had a warm beer and a cold woman?" At that juncture of my young life, I was obviously no man of the world, but I wasn't stupid either. I straightened up, tipped back my straw hat, and fixed John with a grin of my own. "Ain't you got that backwards, John? Don't you mean a cold beer and a warm woman?" For the next minute and a half, it seemed John and Amos might require medical attention. They fell on each other, howling and gasping, hoots of laughter floating like music out over the fields, until John finally recovered enough to lift the corner on the curtain of my innocence. "Nah, Ronnie Ray, I ain't got nothing backward," he said. "The women at Fanny's so hot they got to sit on ice blocks to cool 'em down enough so they can get down to business. Miss Fanny don't be wasting no ice on no beer." Well, that busted open the dam. John knew Granddaddy and Mau Mau were teetotalers and came to regard it as his solemn duty to make sure I didn't see another birthday without having experienced the pleasure of a warm beer. After several days of ribbing, he and Amos finally threw down the gauntlet. "You come on down to Fanny's tonight, and we'll fix you up," John promised. So on a steaming night in August, I eased Granddaddy's 53 Chevy down the hill from the farmhouse, engine quiet, then popped the clutch and drove the 10 miles to Corsicana. My choppin' buddies were waiting for me just across the tracks. I had never been to Niggertown without Granddaddy, so I was plenty nervous as the three of us walked down dirt roads lined with shotgun shacks and not a single light bulb. Mostly folks just sat out on their porches, eyes watching in a black night broken only by a coal oil lantern, a struck match, nor the orange glow of a cigarette. It seemed we'd walked halfway across Texas before the sound of guitar music floated towards us, and like a dream, a low building took shape in the dark. Inside, Fanny's was smoky, red, and dim. At the head of a dirt dance floor, a buxom woman crooned the blues, steaming up the place like a tropical rain on hot sand. John and Amos introduced me to their friends, who greeted me like a local celebrity and handed me a Pabst Blue Ribbon, warm as advertised, then slipped away. For most of the next hour, I sat alone at a corner table, fixated on silhouettes of shirtless men drenched in sweat and women in dresses that clung to their bodies, locked together in a slow, sexual kind of dancing I'd never seen before. I'd heard the music before, though. Real live blues sung by people with names like Lightning Hopkins and Big Fat Sarah over scratchy airwaves beamed live from Laredo at midnight by Wolfman Jack. I pretended to swig on the PBR, but when I was sure nobody was looking, I let it slosh on the dirt floor as I discovered that the smell of beer nauseated me, kicking up memories of me looking for my daddy at the tailless monkey lounge.
Chapter 5. It didn't take long for Big Mama's house to burn down to a heaping pile of smoking red coals. When the flames had died down, I sat there next to it just a-crying, not understanding why God would take away the person I loved the most. After a little while, somebody come and took me and Thurman to live in Grand Bayou with B.B., my daddy. I didn't know him very well, and I still don't know what he did for a living, just that he worked in the city, Shreveport, I think, down past where my Aunt Pearlie May lived. Maybe he was working on the railroad, stacking himself some paper money 'cause he was rich enough to buy him a car, a big old two-door like a Pontiac. B.B. was a big man, heavy-set. He wasn't 6 feet tall, but he looked it, and even though I was just a little fella, I could tell he was popular with the ladies. B.B. liked the ladies, too, and used to keep 3 or 4 of them on a string at the same time. That's why on Sunday mornings, he wouldn't set foot in the new Mary Magdalene Baptist Church. One or two of his women was already married, and they and their husbands was part of the congregation. That didn't mean B.B. didn't love Jesus. He just had to find a different way to visit him on Sundays. So me and him and Thurman would go to church kind of like we was going to a drive-in picture show. Now, the church house wasn't too far off the road. It was painted white and had a real nice pecan tree spreading some shade over some raggedy grass out front. Instead of parking and going in through the big double doors like the rest of the folks, B.B. pulled his Pontiac right up beside the church house. They must have knowed he was coming, 'cause when B.B. drove up, the preacher'd come over and slide up a window right next to the car so we could sit in that Pontiac and listen to the Word of God. I couldn't see nothing inside the church, but I'd hear the choir and the congregation singing some spirituals. I had some favorites, and I would sing along. He's got the rivers and the mountains in his hands. He got the oceans and the seas in his hands. He got you and he's got me in his hands. He got the whole world in his hands. I hope he had Big Mama and Chook in his hands. I was pretty sure he did. After the singing was done, the preacher commenced the preaching. He had a style about him, like to start out soft and low, like he was singing a lullaby. But for long, he worked himself up into a righteous sweat. I remember the way he said God, kind of long and drawled out, sounded like God. And he just loved to talk about sin. Now, sin is when you misses the mark that God is aiming for you to hit, he'd say. Being lazy is a sin, 'cause God is aiming for you to be diligent. Being foolish is a sin, 'cause God is aiming for you to be wise. And being lustful is sin, 'cause God is aiming for you to be chaste. Can I get a witness? Amen. The church would holler, praise Jesus.